Magic Lessons is supported in part by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. They offer an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price with a kind of incredible risk-free trial and return policy. Get this, you actually get to sleep on the mattress for like 100 days, for exactly 100 days. And if you don't like it, you can return it after that. With free delivery anywhere in the U.S. and Canada and painless returns. And, you know, that's what you want in a mattress is painlessness. All the mattresses are made in America, and the pricing starts at $500 for a twin-size mattress and $950 for a king-size mattress, which is pretty extraordinary compared to industry averages. So here is the special offer to listeners of Magic Lessons. Magic Lessons listeners can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/lessons and using the promo code LESSONS at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Just a heads up, everybody, these are adults having adult conversations, so there is the possibility of adult language. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Magic Lessons, a podcast produced by MaximumFun.org. I'm Elizabeth Gilbert, and last year I wrote this book called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. But even when I was finished with the book, I was definitely not finished with the topic because I'm still, as much as ever, fascinated with the intricacies of the creative process and how we find our way through that strange journey, the obstacles we meet along the way, and the joy of what we ultimately create. And it is through my desire to keep having that conversation that this, the Magic Lessons podcast, was born. So here we are. Season 2, and we are back. Back with more real conversations with real people, amateurs and experts. This season, we will be meeting poets and novelists, dancers, photographers, comedians. And whether they're ready or not, me and my friends are going to help them figure out how to shake off their fear, get unstuck, and start making stuff. You know why? Because I think they are ready. So let's go. Today, I'm talking to Hope Hill. She's a spoken word poet from Ohio who's terrified of taking her talents to the next level.
Hello?
Is that Hope?
Hello!
It's so nice to have a phone that you can call and you can be like, is that Hope? Like, we're all looking for that. Is that the line? Hi.
Hi.
I've been wondering how to find you. There she is. How's everything going, love?
Really well. I will say I'm very nervous, but I'm excited too.
That's okay. You're allowed to be nervous. You're allowed to be excited. They generally do tend to go hand in hand. It's okay. And I was going to ask you if you could read for us the essay that you wrote. Thousands of people sent in essays, and yours was really striking to me. So I was wondering if you could just read it for us so everybody could meet you.
Sure. I desperately want to be a spoken word poet. There is a performance poetry venue in my city that I've attended occasionally. I've even gotten on stage on the open mic night. However, I'm so intimidated by the crowd and the other poets. I've been too terrified to do anything more than poetry and write it for myself and selected friends and family. I am just so convinced that my work is too amateur and too boring for anyone else to actually enjoy. I'm not sure how to push myself to the next stage. I'm just stuck.
Oh, honey. Performance anxiety, fear of being criticized, fear of being judged. I mean, what you're talking about when you talk about this public fear is what our dear friend Brené Brown refers to as the arena, you know? Like, it's one thing to quietly and privately live your life and your dreams, and it's another thing to take it up to the next level into the arena. And understandably, that is something that makes you nervous, and it's something that makes a lot of people nervous, which is why I wanted to talk to you. So why don't you back up and tell me, like, give us a little thumbnail about your history with poetry and what it means to you, what it is to you.
Okay. So my mom kind of introduced me to poetry, and she commutes to work, like these 3-hour one-way bus rides. So on her trip, she would just write me and my sister these long letters, these like 14, 20-page longhand letters about things that she saw, things that she did. At home, she would just write poems, really silly poems for a lot of like school projects or things like that. And I love my mom. I wanted to be just like her, so I started writing kind of on my own in my little notebooks and diaries. And it just kind of was my way of expressing myself. I'm really introverted and very, very shy. I have a hard time going and making friends or talking to people, being the first one to introduce themselves. So it was kind of my way of getting out of my own head, out of like my imagination sometimes, and kind of feeling out the world in a really safe way. And I would just kind of do like an online private like Word document journal until, I would say like a year and a half, 2 years ago, when a friend of mine said like, oh, hey, I'm going to this open mic and I'm going to read. If you're not doing anything, come out and see me perform. So I went and I just was really wowed by the crowd and how enthusiastic they were, how supportive they were. And I just kind of saw a community there that I didn't realize existed in my own backyard. So I started going more often, and with some urging from friends and family, like, you should sign up for the open mic. So I did, and I read, and it's a really good feeling, sharing it with like strangers and feeling connected to them and hearing their words. It's just the whole vibe is just really energetic. And as someone who gets kind of drained by social interactions, it's really nice to be around people and not to feel tired, like you have to go home and recharge. And that's one of the things I love about performance poetry and slam poetry, is just that even if you lose, even if you flub, even if you forget a line halfway through, the crowd still has your back, the other poets still have your back. They're just very connected and together and supportive, and that's kind of what I want for myself.
That sounds amazing. I was about to say, you, my dear, have what I like to call not a problem. You found the work that you love. You found the community that you love being in. You know, you're kind of doing everything that I'm always telling people to do. Make your work, share your work, find your tribe, you know, put it out there. So what is the obstacle at this point?
I think that's kind of like, I feel like I'm on the edge of like a diving board, is just going, like I read on the open mic and that's fine. But getting to that next level where it's signing up for a slam or submitting to a journal, because it's, you know, I'm not putting myself in a position to necessarily be rejected. I think that's a big fear of mine, is hearing a no or getting a no, and pushing past that huge fear of rejection or booing or people throwing shoes at me on stage.
And, is that what they do in Ohio? You're going to have to stand behind chicken netting, or are people going to be throwing beer bottles at you? How bad does it get?
Like, you know, I build up in my head that it's going to be this really negative thing. And if I never, you know, put myself in a position to be rejected, then I can never be rejected.
Right, right.
So how do I do that? How do I put myself out there and be vulnerable in such a different way?
Okay, so first of all, I want to congratulate you, because as somebody who, you know, obviously you're an introvert, and obviously you're deeply sensitive, and you really do seem to have the soul of a poet. You know, most of our poets are deeply sensitive introverts. That's why they become poets. You know, that's why they don't become showgirls. You know, like there's a whole different sort of personality that goes along with the sort of traditional spirit of what a poet is. And the world can be very hard and painful for people like you, because the world's not very careful with each other. So the first step of you even showing it to your loved ones is like, if you think of it as like concentric circles of, you know, where it comes from, this tiny little pearl that comes from you, and then it gets bigger when you show it to your friends and family. And then you took the next step out of that to the next concentric circle, which is public performance. So you've already done remarkably brave things, and you've already found a really loving community. So just for a moment, give yourself some credit. Like, do you see? Like, that's pretty amazing. Secondly, the thing that you're talking about escalating to, I think if I understand correctly, is the more combative world of poetry slams and competitions.
Yeah.
And then there's the dehumanizing, anonymous opposite of a poetry slam, which is the combat of sending your work out to journals and having them write you a letter that might as well come from an insurance company saying that we're not interested in you, right? Which is just as bad in a totally different way.
Right.
because both of them are huge acts of rejection, right? One of them is a huge act of rejection from an impersonal source at the Poetry Journal. The other one is an intimate and right up in your face, huge act of rejection from a live audience who might boo. Do they boo? Does that happen? Do people, I mean, how bad does it get out there?
I've never heard anyone boo. Typically, even if you are terrible and no one is terrible, even if you're not well-liked by the crowd, they don't boo. They will still clap. They will still cheer. They might rank you a one, but which is bad.
Okay, so this little story you were telling me at the beginning about not wanting to do this because you don't want people booing and throwing shoes at you, we can just assume that unless you are so bad, that you're so much worse than everyone, that they're going to break the laws of civility and actually do like physical and emotional harm to you is probably not going to happen, right?
Right.
We can assume that. Here's the thing. What I need to know is, what are you afraid is going to happen to you specifically if you are rejected? You've set it up very carefully so far in your life that you never have to experience that. And so obviously that's a traumatic idea for you. So I want you to walk me through what's going to happen in Hope's heart, soul, mind, and spirit when she gets that letter from the Poetry Journal, or when she gets the sort of silent, polite one clap in the audience from the Poetry Slam. What are you afraid is going to happen to you?
So much of my identity is tied to what I do, whether that's been work or school or the things I feel like I'm good at, which has been work and school. And if, you know, I get that rejection, whether it's like the crown or the letter, then, you know, clearly I'm not good enough to be a poet. So who am I now? Like, what do I do with my life now? You got rejected, so clearly you're not a poet. And like, you're not a good writer, so...
Oh, honey. Now, I want to know, because I really need to know, how little is it going to take for you to believe that you're not a poet? Let's just play that you send one poem to one poetry journal, and you get back 6 weeks later a nondescript envelope in the mail, and they say, we don't want your poem. Are you imagining that that's... it. At that moment, your poetry journey has finished. You will never either write poetry or show poetry again. Is that a possibility, or do you have the resilience or the reserve that you could maybe deal with two of those? Could you get a year of them? What's it going to take to break Hope Hill? That's what I want to know. Like, how little and how much? And what happens when you get that rejection letter in the mail?
There are a couple of things there. So if knowing myself and knowing that I fear rejection, like if I like really shot for the stars and like submitted my best poems, like the most exclusive, like the Ivy League of journals, and they turned me down, I think I would be, you know, disappointed and hurt. But knowing myself and knowing that I'm a baby poet, I wouldn't take it that personally.
Okay, the stakes just got a little lower. Go ahead, keep going.
If I, you know, like a medium range private school of journals rejected like my best poem, I would be more hurt, but I think I would, I'd still write. I think it would take something incredibly traumatic for me to stop writing entirely.
Right.
Even if it's just like for myself or for like my family or my friends.
Right.
But I think I might rethink sharing them.
Right.
If I'm being like totally honest, I might like take a year from performing them, even at open mics, just really look at my poems. And I am a nerdy person, which I'm totally proud of. So like look into poetry writing guides and talk to poets out there and say like, hey, I got rejected by this magazine that was really good or maybe not so good. And I don't know what I did wrong because I don't know what I'm doing, really.
Pro tip, nobody does. but go on. Yeah, yeah. So you would try going to a bunch of experts to get a better, stronger game.
Yeah.
And now you're going to do those, you're going to send those letters out, and now you get rejected again. Now what happens?
I guess I want to be the person that would keep doing it.
Right.
But I fear that I might not be. And that's super scary to say out loud.
Well, it's kind of great to say it out loud, because once you say it out loud, now we know what we're dealing with. Right? Like our friend Brené Brown always says, you got to keep your shadow in front of you where you can see it, right? And the way to keep it in front of you where you can see it is to say it out loud. So the reason I'm talking you through this is because I have a question that I just wrote down on my little scrapbook here as I'm listening to you talk. And the question is, who gets to decide if you're a poet? And I don't mean people generally, I mean specifically you. Who gets to decide if Hope is a poet?
I want it to be me. Like, there's a part of me that is so true and like so honest. And I feel like if my heart had a voice, this is what it would say. Is that like, you are regardless. Mm-hmm. You are a poet regardless. Even if like, it was a horrible accident. I lost my hands. Like, I'd find a way to write somehow.
Right.
But I just get so bogged down with, you're not as good as so-and-so, or you'll never be as accomplished as so-and-so, or, you know, beloved as so-and-so. And I'm not sure how to separate like, the trueness that I feel like comes from the core of me, that, like, you are regardless, from
public opinion.
I just want to be loved.
The tyranny of public opinion.
I want everyone to love me.
Hey, look, if you want to get in a contest of I want everyone to love me, you're going to have a hard time wanting it more than I do, right? Like, we all, like, I know you, and I know this. Because I feel like this is the central question that we have to do. And the first assignment that I'm going to give you is that I want you to write this sentence, and I want you to make art out of this sentence. I want you to make a proclamation out of this sentence. You don't have to answer it, but I just want it somewhere where you can see it. And the question is, who gets to decide if Hope Hill is a poet, right?
Okay.
And I want that where you can see it every day. And I want you to ask yourself that every day, because I can tell you this, if the answer is anything other than Hope Hill, then you're setting yourself up for a lifetime of suffering. Because your art will forever be dependent upon other people. Even if 100 of them tell you that you're a great poet, if one of them tells you that you're not, then you risk losing who you are. What I think many of us are weirdly, subconsciously, darkly looking for is we're waiting for the one person who's going to tell us the thing that the darkest inner voice in ourselves says, which is, you're a failure. You're a fraud. You don't belong. You're not worthy. You're not one of us. And some of us will not rest until we find the person who will say that. So if your answer to the question, who gets to decide if Hope Hill is a poet, is not Hope Hill, then the answer to that question is, it's that guy, right? Mm-hmm. It's that guy. It's going to be that person. I'm waiting to find that person who's going to tell me that Hope Hill is not a poet, and then I'll believe it, and then I'll stop. And that would be a terrible, terrible loss for you and for us, because we need you to make your art. And in answer to the question of, but I fear that I'm not as good as fill in the blank names of famous great poets, my reply, because you're an adult, and I think I can talk to you like an adult, is you probably aren't. You know, and that's what I tell myself all the time when I say, I'm not as good a writer as Ann Patchett. I'm not as good a writer as Jonathan Franzen. I'm not as good a writer as Hilary Mantel. And I don't even know who the worst is or who the greatest is, but I know that there's an enormous amount of real estate between the worst writer and the best writer, and that there's a lot of room in there. And somewhere in there is me. And I'm in there because I put myself in there, not because I was invited in, because I stepped in and said, hey, I'm here. And you know what they do? The big crowd of creators in the world, when you step in, they sort of shuffle aside and they make a little room for you. And you've seen this already happen at open mic night, right? It's like they made a little room for you. There you are. Not the greatest, not the worst, but there, present, right? This is what the poet David White calls the arrogance of belonging. You know, the arrogance of belonging is not the arrogance that says I'm the greatest, or the flip side of arrogance, which is the self-abusive narcissism that says I'm the worst. The arrogance of belonging is just a quiet voice that says I'm neither the greatest nor the worst, but I'm present and I'm here. And I'm here because I'm deciding to be here, because Hope Hill gets to decide if Hope Hill is a poet. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And this is a really important thing. I want you to write a list of every woman's name in your family's history, living or dead, who never had a public voice.
Okay.
If we're going to do this with my family, that list is every single one of them. Go back a couple generations and tell me what the lives of the women who brought you into this world at this moment in history, what those lives looked like.
Right now?
Yep. Just okay. run through. Just throw grandmothers, great-grandmothers. What did their lives look like?
Well, both my grandmothers had many children and worked full-time jobs in addition to having those many children, and had very unhappy marriages to very intense, controlling men.
So weird. It sounds like all of our grandmothers.
Yeah. They're in a club together.
Yeah.
I believe my great-grandmothers were slaves, if I'm thinking correctly.
Right.
And then...
Am I correct to assume that they did not have a public voice?
No, you are correct.
They didn't even have a public body. They didn't even have a legal presence in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back farther than that?
I'm assuming more slaves.
Yeah.
And then probably somewhere in Africa. I don't know much about my extended family, but I can only imagine that they also did not have, you know, very public voices that were celebrated very much at all.
Yeah. Right. So do you see where I'm going with this? Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. To be criticized is the tax that you pay for having a public voice. Mm-hmm. To be rejected is the tax that you pay for having a public voice. There's a very simple way to make sure that you're never criticized and never rejected, and that is to never have a public voice. You can do that. You can choose that. And I actually think that people are totally allowed to choose that. If you know yourself, if you know your sensitivities, and you want to make quiet art in your room for yourself, I think that's noble. But if you're not speaking more publicly because you're afraid, then that's a different story. And if the thing that you're afraid of is to be rejected or criticized, then you're not willing to pay the tax that comes with the tremendous privilege of having the opportunity to have a public voice. I might be able to guess here that you might be the first female in the entire history of your family who has the possibility of having a public voice. Is that possibly true?
That's possibly true, yeah.
So what I feel, just from like a deeply mystical sense here, is the sound of countless, endless generations of the women who came before you begging you to use that voice because they couldn't. And if you remain as quiet as they were when they were oppressed and they had no options, I believe there's a certain level at which you're doing a disservice to the sacrifices and the pain and the suffering that they went through. I think they want you bigger in the world than they were, right?
Right.
And when I'm feeling really small, which is what criticism and insult. And any time of day that I feel like confirming that I'm worthless, I will find with one click of my mouse somebody who's very happy to tell me that in a public forum, right? Whenever that makes me feel like going in a corner and being really still and quiet and not ever letting that happen again, I think of my mother and my grandmother and my grandmothers before them, all of which, my God, hope they would have given anything to have the chance to be a presence in the world, right? And mm-hmm. I feel them behind me saying, put it out there again. And if you can't put it out there again for yourself, put it out there for us who never had a voice.
Right.
That's the tax I'm willing to pay to be a woman who presents her soul's work into the world in honor of all those who never could and in all those today who still can't, right? So I don't know if that makes you feel more free and more brave or if it makes you feel more burdened. So tell me if that makes you feel more free and more brave or if it makes you feel more burdened. And if it makes you feel more burdened, we'll go in a different direction.
it makes you feel more free, definitely. My mom and I were having a conversation a couple of weeks ago where she told me that she was so encouraged by me going to open mics, and she came down and saw me at one, that she was going to print out copies of her poems and go to like a feedback circle. Unfortunately, she ended up kind of not doing that, and she was feeling pretty upset, sad, disappointed in herself. This is just so ironic. This is what I told her. But it's just like, Mom, like, you're still a poet.
Yes. Yes.
Say it to yourself in the mirror. Like, you're like, you don't have to put yourself out there if you're not ready, if you don't want to, or like anything like that. Like, because she's such an inspiration to me, and her writing means so much to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't even believe that she would think that about herself.
You know, it's so funny because it's so easy to see in others, and it's so hard to generate in ourselves. And Hope, you and I, we have the privilege of making art that people hate. What a lucky thing that we get to do that with our lives, you know? Of course, what we really want is to make art that people love, and that's what we're going to keep trying to do. But we also have the privilege of making art that people don't like, and that's its own kind of strange privilege. So your assignments, you have to write down that question, who gets to decide if Hope Hill is a poet? I want you to write that down as beautifully as you can, decorate it, do whatever you have to do with it, tattoo it on you, whatever it is. okay. You know, the next assignment is that you have to do this real, like, deep spirit work about calling up your ancestors and really looking at the lives they had versus the life that you have, and asking them to write you letters of support, asking them to petition, asking yourself what they want you to do, right?
Okay.
And that's a sort of an exercise that I think will be very important to you, and you can return to it time and time and time again. And the third thing is that I want you to go to a poetry slam before I talk to you again. Can you do that? I'm going to call you. Is there one coming up? Is there something in the next few weeks that that you can go to so that I can call and check and make sure that you're – or you have to send – no, not or, and you have to send you have to send a poem out to a journal.
Okay.
And you have to send it out with the assumption that you're sending it out to begin your collection of rejection letters. And that is a collection that I'm very excited for you to have, because every writer I know has one. You'll be joining the canon of all of us. We all have them. I keep them like sacred objects, because when I started getting them was when I knew that I was finally on my way. So I need you to send something out to some magazines, and I need you to go to a poetry slam. Can it be done?
Yes.
Okay.
You never have to travel to outside of Ohio.
Yeah, you're going to have to travel outside of Ohio. Hey, guess whose relatives weren't allowed to travel? Yours, right? Like, again, right. It is not a burden to have to travel out of Ohio. It is a privilege to be able to travel out of Ohio, to go to a poetry slam, and to have a public voice as a woman, and especially as a woman with your particular history, right? Like, this is all an incredible privilege. And the pain of it is a tiny price to pay for the extraordinary opportunity that you have to start to rewrite history, you know? I had another, a third assignment. I want you to write a letter from your imaginary great-grandchildren to you, telling them how amazing the inspiration of your life was to their lives.
Oh.
This is a letter that's written after you're dead, okay? And they're going to tell you why their great-grandmother, Hope Hill, was so important in the family history. So we're reaching back in time to dead ancestors, and we're reaching forward in time to the unborn who are coming. And you're the fulcrum at the center of it right now. And your voice and your work, you will see through these letters how important it is. Can you do it?
I can do it.
Okay. And I am going to call a friend of mine to give me further advice for you. She is a columnist for Oprah magazine. Her name is Martha Beck. She's amazing. She's a life coach. Look, she's Oprah's life coach. Okay. So I think she can totally be our life coach for the day.
All right.
And I'm going to tell her your story, if that's okay with you. And I'm going to get further advice from her about how we find courage to face not the rejection that might come, Hope, but the rejection that will come. So I can't wait for you to start getting rejection letters, because that's when you get to join us and be one of us, because that's what we all have. Does that make sense?
It does.
All right.
I got a lot of things to get started on. Got a lot of homework.
I gave you a lot of homework. It's okay. You told me you liked school.
I'm really excited.
Okay, cool. Hope, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. And I can't wait to hear what your great-grandmother has to say to you, and I can't wait to hear what your great-grandkids have to say to you. And in the meantime, make a date. Go to that poetry slam. You may have to drive out of Ohio. It's been done before. All right, sweetheart. Lots of love.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll be talking with Martha Beck, the great Martha Beck about Hope's case. But first, a word from our sponsors. You probably don't think about going to the post office. It's just sort of one of the things that's on your list throughout the day, and it's become second nature to you. But when you stop to think about it, it's got hassle involved. You got to stop what you're doing. You got to interrupt your projects. You got to drive there. You got to find parking. You got to wait. It turns out there's a much better way to do mail, and that is, of course, Stamps.com. Stamps.com is the easy and convenient way to get postage right from your desk. You can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. With Stamps.com, there's no guesswork. They make it easy to get exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail the instant you need it. No expensive postage meters to lease and no more trips to the post office. You got to try it. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code, LESSONS, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in this word, lessons. That's Stamps.com. Enter lessons.
Hi, are you a fan of Star Trek The Next Generation? Well, that's weird because it's a corny show. But my friends Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica do a lovely podcast about it. It's called The Greatest Generation, and it's on MaximumFun.org. I thought that this podcast was a bad idea, but I was wrong. Please listen to The Greatest Generation on MaximumFun.org.
Okay, we are back. Before the break, we heard from Hope, a spoken word poet in Ohio who is having trouble moving on to the next stage of her artistic journey. And now it's time to talk about her case with Martha Beck. Martha Beck, writer, life coach, one of my favorite human beings in the world. You might know her from the pages of O Magazine, where she dispenses basically the best advice there is on earth on a monthly basis. She's been a great guide and a friend to me over the years when it comes to helping me summon up my own courage to live the biggest and most honest version of my life that I can, and that's why I wanted to reach out and talk to her about hope. Is that Martha Beck, my spirit animal, on the phone?
Is that my possum?
Oh, yes, it is.
How are you doing, tiny one?
I'm good, giant one. And that is in no way a reference to our body shapes, everybody. Hi, love. Thank you so much for taking this call.
And
for,
are you kidding?
You're the greatest. And we need you because this is a podcast where I try to help people, and you're the pro at that.
I don't know. I give it a college try, though.
Please do the whole podcast in that oaky from...
It's just going to vary wildly. I can't control it. You'll just have to live with that. It's my creative expression, damn it.
That's right. Please tell me you're wearing scarves and dancing as you're saying that.
Of course.
So, this week, we've been talking to Hope Hill, who is a young spoken word poet from Ohio. And she's a deeply introverted, very shy, sensitive soul. And she has been taking these like incremental steps of bringing her poetry out of herself and revealing it into the world. But, you know, it's scary for her because she doesn't want to be hurt. So it started with trusted friends and families. And then the next circle was a poetry group, you know, in a very loving open mic setting where everybody's really supportive and kind and generous. And now she feels like it's time for her to take it to the next level, which is to finally put herself in a situation where she might get rejected or hurt. She's been really careful so far. In her own words, she's been very careful to avoid any situation where she can be rejected. And so now she wants to do poetry slams, which is a much more athletic version of this.
Oh, yeah.
And where the audience is a lot less gentle. And she also wants to start sending her work out to poetry journals. So I had a long talk with her about this, but I just sort of want to turn it over to you at this point to begin with this concept. I thought this was really interesting and very self-aware what she said about how I've been very careful not to put myself in situations where I can be rejected. And now she's tentatively ready to start that. What does that signal to you? What does that spur in you? What do you think that's all about?
Well, I think if she really wants to avoid getting hurt, she's come to the wrong planet. It's just, it's not going to happen. It's one of the things that is my little trick in writing, I'll tell you right now. You don't tell people there's a way to avoid pain. You tell them there's no way to avoid pain, but you can become very, very resilient.
Right.
So avoidance of pain ends up creating its own kind of pain, which is artistic suffocation, right?
Right.
And that's a terrible, terrible pain that you are trying to address with the magic lessons, which I absolutely love. My way of getting through it may not be everyone's. I had a terrible fear of public speaking, so as a teenager, I joined the debate club, got up in front of a judge and fainted dead away.
Oh, nice.
On the floor.
Nice story.
Yeah, and I looked up and they were looking down at me saying, do you want to continue? And I'm like, well, I guess this is the worst that can happen. So I got up and I finished my speech and I never had stage fright afterward. I know what the worst that can happen is.
Right.
And I've done the same thing over and over. I just sort of leap into the fire because I can't tolerate the fear. And the fire is actually less horrifying than the fear.
Right, right. Last year, I did a lot of talking on the podcast about trying to take away this jump and the net will catch you bumper sticker. Because, look, we're all grown-ups and we know that sometimes you jump and you break a bone, you know, or six.
Yeah. Sometimes you die and sometimes you wish you had died.
Right.
And that's very real. And the pretense that it isn't actually spikes very, very high anxiety, continuous high anxiety, which is the death of your creativity.
Right.
So my way is to snuff out the flames by running straight into them and burning up. That may not be your optimal path, Hope. It's not what I would tell my children to do.
Is it not? Why not?
Because I am more afraid of my children getting hurt than I am of being hurt myself. Fortunately, by watching me, they've ended up being leap into the flames people themselves.
Right.
Thing about it is, nothing is better material for your art then what happens when you jump into the flames and get burned.
Right.
Like, it is so generative of a whole new, vast array of artistic possibilities.
It's all copy, as the great Nora Ephron used to say.
Exactly.
Or another way, I don't even know who originated this term, nothing bad ever happens to a writer.
Right, it's all material. That was Garrison Keillor.
Right, right. Most of us, the worst time of our life, it all looks pretty much the same. Usually involves fetal position on a bathroom floor, right?
Always.
Like, I don't know why it's always the bathroom. Maybe it's the privatest
better
place.
Better acoustics.
Better acoustics for the wailing sobs. But, you know, I know very, very few people who I love and admire and would listen to have not been in fetal position on the bathroom floor at a pile of their own snot at some point in their life. I mean, that's kind of where the interesting part of people's lives tends to begin.
It is.
But in the moment, it never feels like it because your pain is so immediate. It's hard when you're bleeding to be like, oh, someday this is going to be great.
It wouldn't be authentic if you weren't fully in pain to the point where it didn't feel like material. If you're doing it for art's sake, it's always a lie. If you're suffering for the sake of your art, that is a facile imitation of actual suffering. Actual suffering is not bearable. Let's be clear. It is not bearable. But in my world, the only reason for creativity, for myself and for anybody else, is to find the human soul in that condition.
Right.
And find a way in to bring grace.
Wow.
So, yeah, I agree. It's very annoying to have someone tell you, oh, this will make a great novel someday.
Uh-huh.
But there on the bathroom floor, what you open to is not other people's advice about art. It is your own voice.
Right.
The voice, as Mary Oliver says, that you slowly began to recognize as your own.
Right.
And it always does one thing. It offers you kindness.
Right.
And that's what happened to you, right?
Right.
Go back to bed, Liz.
Right, right.
That was it. That was the simple, compassionate movement that took you out of agony and into just barely tolerable.
Right.
And then your whole book was about the expansion of that voice. So
my whole life has been about the expansion of this.
Yeah. And I think all art and creativity must be, because you're going to serve one of two things. You're going to serve ego or you're going to serve love.
Right.
And if you're doing it for ego, I'm not interested. And if you're doing it for love, I don't care if it's crudely done, badly phrased, misspelled. I want it. So the fact that Hope is an extreme introvert, I would know nothing about that, is weirdly an advantage because there are more fires for her.
Right, right. Everything's a fire.
Right. And so the instructions I would give are go into a fire. If it celebrates you and warms you, more power to you. find the next step that's frightening, go into it, and if it scorches you or it burns you or it consumes you utterly, then you find a kindness that is so great that it can encompass the burning. And from that kindness, your poetry will start to ring to other people's suffering, and that's art.
Martha, do me a favor. Do you have a mic you can drop? just drop the cell phone.
Boom!
Out. Martha, that's everything. That's everything. You know, one of the things I'm very interested in is the way in which people keep looking for somebody to confirm for them the very worst version of their idea of themselves, right? And I was saying to Hope, what she has to be careful about is that if there's 100 people who praise her work and she can't hear them, and she can only hear the one who degrades it, because she needs confirmation, right? Of the darkest, worst voice inside of her that tells her that she's unworthy and she's a failure and she's a fraud. And now it's been proven because Doug at the Poetry Slam said so, right? Or once you get to a certain level, the New York Review of Books said so, or the Paris Review says so, like whoever. And the big question that I had for her was, who gets to decide if Hope Hill is a poet? Mm-hmm. And it was incredible how long the silence was after I asked her that. She had the right answer, but it was, she said, I want it to be me, you know? And how do you guide when you work with people? How do you guide them to the point where they get to answer who gets to decide who they are?
Well, I always divide, and this gives them a language for it, the social self from the essential self. The social self, most of the brain is geared to take in social cues and do what is expected of us or what pleases others. And then there's an essential self that would be the same if we were born in Guatemala or Timbuktu or Paris. And that part of us is, it's genetic. It's our inherent self. And probably most people's lives, because I don't think of just art as art. I think of every day when you get up in the morning as a work of art. The day is a work of art. So you have two choices. You're going to do what your society says, or you're going to do what your essence says. Mm. You're either going to imitate or create. Those are your only two options.
Mm-hmm.
So to stop and say, what is my essence leaning toward? What is my essence yearning for? I love it in Big Magic when you say sometimes it's just a slight pull of the head toward, you know, you describe gardening. It's weird because the one time I met you in person, you were talking about, I just like gardening lately. And then I read The Signature of All Things, and I was like, oh, yeah, you just like gardening?
Martha, I just liked gardening right then because it was the only thing I was interested in. I wasn't interested in writing another book until
I started
gardening and then discovered, oh, I want to write a novel about this. That's how it is. It's like,
that's the essence.
That's it.
Yep. Life is a work of art.
Yes.
And it's every single day. And the less you choose to imitate and the more you choose authenticity, the more that becomes a muscle that is powerful. You can get to the point where you can go out in front of a bunch of people who hate you and hold your own and stay calm and not be afraid. Well, be afraid but not care that you're afraid.
Right.
And then your life starts to become big magic. It really starts to look like miracles.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal, the power of ignoring society. So I would like her to have a sign that says, I respectfully do not care. I was writing a book once, and I wrote about my son who has Down syndrome, and I said, I live with a Zen master, and if you disagree, and I was going to make my, you know, I was going to soften it for all the people who don't think the way I think. And I ended up saying, if you disagree, I respectfully do not care.
Right.
I know what he is.
Oh,
I know what
man.
My journey is. And it's that kind of rock solid, this is what I'm interested in today, and all I want to do is sit and make designs out of Fruit Loops, and I respectfully do not care what you think.
And the other thing is that I've learned, Martha, is that the critic, whether it's the amateur in his boxer shorts on the internet at 3 o'clock in the morning or the professional at the Wall Street Journal, right? The critic is part of the ecosystem of the whole story. You put something in the world, and when you do, there's a response, right? Mm-hmm. The really great way to not get a response is to not put anything there, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you send a vibrational something into the world in any form, there will be a response to it. And that must be allowed. Because as I always think when I start to get sort of tiny and petulant about my critics, who are many, I think if I get to have a public voice, they also get to have a public voice.
Right?
It's actually very childish for me to say, I want to make art, but nobody gets to respond to it.
Right?
Now, you can do that. It's okay to say, I'm going to make art for my own joy and pleasure in my room, and I'm not showing it to anybody because I don't care about anybody. That's one thing, mm-hmm. you know? But to say, I'm going to make art and I'm going to hoard it because it's not fair for people to have a response to something that I put out in the world vibrationally is childish thinking.
And it's trying to control other people. It's a form of tyranny, weirdly. You're trying to control the entire world so that it doesn't turn on you. Good luck with that, because it will find a way to turn on you whether or not you put your art out there for them.
Right.
So the way to unfold that is just to, bit by bit, start asking yourself every day, what art is it that wants to flow through you that way, putting it out in front of people, and when they have a positive reaction or a negative reaction, getting back inside yourself and remembering the joy of the creation.
Right.
Because for me, it is murder to start focusing on anyone's response, positive, negative. I don't care. I really have to stop caring, and that means I don't look at it at all, really. Like, I don't even read reviews. I don't read reviews on Amazon. I never check to see how a book is doing. Never. I just move on and keep writing.
Because by the time they're criticizing it, you're already in something else, hopefully, right?
Because the joy of making stuff, and it's not just writing. I sit around, and I'm making a coloring book now to go with the last book I made. One day there was something I had to express, and it could only be expressed by playing a Beethoven sonata, but I could not play the piano, so I had to learn. You know, it's just, I really am playing for myself and my dogs. I'm writing for myself and my dogs. And the wonderful thing about it is, you said something about the frequency of creativity. I was talking to Byron Katie, one of my idols, a spiritual teacher, about a book that I wrote where I really did get death threats and lawsuits and really serious reactions in the aftermath.
Can you tell us a bit, just for people who aren't familiar with your...
Sure. I wrote a book about growing up in the home of a very illustrious figure in the Mormon community, religion, and the strangeness thereof and the way I left my religion when I began to believe in God and what that process was like. I thought nobody would notice. I really have never thought of myself as a big deal at all. So I was like, six people will read this. Who cares? And it turned out a lot of people cared. So there was a national campaign of negative publicity. I got organized hate mail, not just, the occasional loon who would describe in graphic detail how he was going to kill me or my children, but also like entire bodies of people who wanted me to die. It was really, really brutal. I'm telling you, it was brutal. And I was talking to Byron Katie about that, and I said, you know, I was completely past all anger when I wrote and promoted that book, but I still had fear.
Right.
And because I still had fear, there was an opening where I could be accessed. And she said, yes, sweetie, she's so wonderful. She said, if you wrote that book from the state of consciousness you're in now, no one would have said a thing against you. I mean, they might have not liked it,
right?
But they could not have attacked you. And I've actually watched her work with someone who was a violent criminal who was running toward her screaming, I'm going to kill you, and then dropped at her feet, sobbing.
Wow.
And she gets down on the floor and holds them.
Oh, my God.
So when you say big magic, I mean, I've seen some big magic in my day. And that, if you show up to love the world instead of showing up to serve your ego, number one, whether you're afraid or not, does not matter. You are showing up to serve the world. And number two, it becomes beautiful to those who are suffering along with you, and no one else matters.
How old were you when you started sorting this out, Martha?
Started doing what?
Sorting out, like knowing this. How old were you when you started knowing that?
It was really when I was 25, and I was in my doctoral program at Harvard, and my second child was diagnosed very late in pregnancy with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And all five doctors at the Harvard Health Center said that I had 2 weeks to decide on a termination or continuing. And that meant that I'd already seen him suck his finger on the ultrasound, and I fought to keep him alive. And I'm very pro-choice, but he was already my baby.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do it. And all these very prestigious, very wise people came in, not just the doctors, but my advisors at Harvard, my classmates. And they just told me over and over, you're throwing your life away. Hmm. And it was a matter of life or death. And so I didn't cave. I found my real response.
Right.
And I threw my life away. And they were right. I threw my life away. And the life I threw away sucked compared to the life I got back.
Wow.
Every time you go into the fire, you come out with a new life, and it's better than the last.
Oh, Martha, now I'm crying.
I cried enough for both of us.
I've never heard those words turned, you know, but that's what you do. where, yes, I'm going to throw my life away. That's exactly what I need to do.
Yeah, over and over and over again. You're out of your mind.
Yeah.
Good. All the best things happen outside of mind.
Right. Wow. So the other thing that I was talking with Hope about was that I gave her an assignment to write herself letters from her female ancestors who never had a public voice. Asking her to have a public voice, or telling her what it was like not to have one, you know? And I think that's so important, because I think for women particularly, this fear of being rejected, this fear of being criticized, this fear of being insulted and degraded prevents them from perhaps having the public voice that we might want them to have, right?
Yeah.
And that we might need them to have, and that they want to have, in a way. And that certainly would improve the culture if they did have. So do you have any special thoughts about that in terms of women's creativity and women's courage, and what that strikes in you when I say that?
Yeah, it was very deep for me, because I was raised to be a good Mormon girl, like right in the heart of that subculture. And there was a group that did an artist's exhibit for women artists from all 50 states, and they put it up in Washington, D.C., every state. And they came and presented to some people from Utah, and they said Utah was the weirdest state, because all the women put out art showing images of women with no mouths, or with their mouths sewn shut, or with locks on their throats, or their heads bound in rope or something. And they were all about not having a voice. And when they put these paintings and drawings and sculptures on display, the church bussed in women to picket the exhibit so that nobody could get in, thereby magnifying the truth that the artists were trying to state.
Wow.
So when I had a story to tell about that, and I had a small platform, I'd written a couple bestsellers, and I really thought it would be my physical death and the death of my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if I don't tell these women's stories, because it is my story,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is the story I have to tell. I don't have anybody else's life story.
Right.
And I waited years, and then it just became such a strong inward pressure that not to do it would have been such a lie. So I wrote this book that I mentioned before, and as I said, I got just assaulted from everywhere. A lot of people loved it, but the hatred was so loud and so continuous and so aggressive and so organized. They tried to arrest me, everything. So I didn't want to go to Utah ever again, but I love to ski. So after that, like, I was living in Arizona, and one day I got up at 5 a.m, got all my ski stuff, and there is no snow like Utah snow. You're spoiled for anything else. So I go to the Salt Lake Airport, and I run into Starbucks, because Mormons don't drink coffee. And I think, okay, I'm safe in here. And I seriously considered wearing my ski mask, a balaclava, and goggles. But then they would have thought I was there to rob them. So I went and I got a coffee. And I ordered it, and the barista made it. And she handed me the coffee. And I took it. And then she reached out her other hand, and she grabbed my hand. And she said, thank you for writing that book.
Wow.
And I just went, boom, drop the coffee. That is my moment. Like,
right.
If it had just been that woman,
right,
it would have all been worth it.
Ah.
Because I had to go back for the lost pieces of myself.
You know, it's funny, when I'm trying to push people to put themselves out in public, and those people are women, Sometimes I find that the only way to, that I can get them to do it is when I say, do it for your sisters and your daughters. And,
right.
You know, and part of me wishes that they would just do it for themselves, but it's not in the sort of training.
Well, can I tell you a weird story here?
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
The whole time, when I was trying to get the courage, I would always ask my future self to come give me advice.
Okay.
So I would always ask myself at 50, because that was obviously intensely ancient.
And so deeply wise. By 30, 50, everything is sorted out, right?
I know. 50, it's all over. So I'd ask my 50-year-old self, and I would write down, what did you do to get through this? And my 50-year-old self would come back and say, you have no idea. Everything's fine.
Aww.
But then I turned 50, Liz, and here's the weird thing. I meditate a lot, right?
Right.
I kept getting sucked back in to the moments when I was writing to my 50-year-old self, and I swear to God, I went in and gave the advice.
You were time traveling! Oh my God, you were bending time!
Yes, I know!
Big magic!
I got really excited. But it was so weird. It was like, holy crap!
Oh my God!
I really was the one helping me that whole
time. It really was you. It really was. Oh, that's amazing.
So try going to yourself after death. That one's safe.
That's funny because one of the assignments that I gave to Hope was that she also had to write a letter from her great grandchildren, writing about why their great grandmother changed the whole trajectory of their family's history.
There you go.
And so I made her reach way back, and I made her reach way forward to put it in a grander perspective about how these things matter, you know?
Yes, because and you know what her rocket ship, her time travel machine to the past and the future is? It can only be love.
Right.
So you're asking her to get on board that ship.
Yeah.
And if the moment you're working for love instead of for ego, you are the creator. You're not just creative. You are aligned with all creation. You are the creator, and nothing can stop you.
On that note, Martha, I will say my fond goodbye. That is everything. That is everything I believe. And that's why I do this. And I do it to remind myself of it again and again and again.
And thank you for writing for love, Liz.
Hey.
And for me and for everyone. Thank you so much.
It's the best game in town.
Right?
And thank you, Martha, for everything you've done for all of us over the years and will continue to do. You know, we're all just walking each other home, and it's great. So
good luck, Hope.
Yes. Go Hope and all the hopes. May all the hopes come into bloom.
Amen.
Thank you, Martha.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so yeah, that's Martha Beck, everybody. Now you know why she's so awesome. She's an amazing writer and an endlessly generous life coach. Her bestsellers include Expecting Adam, Finding Your Own North Star, and her newest novel, which is Dynamite, Diana Herself, An Allegory of Awakening. It's already one of my favorite books I've ever read. Beck is also a columnist for O, the Oprah magazine, and you can find out a lot more about her at marthabeck.com. Like many of you, I assume, I am always happiest when I'm learning new things. And that's why I've come to really enjoy The Great Courses Plus, and I encourage you to try it too. With The Great Courses Plus, you will have unlimited access to a wealth of knowledge, being able to learn so much about different topics like history, literature, art, cooking, photography, presented by award-winning professors from all over the world, people who you would normally have to be attending Harvard, for instance, in order to enjoy. But you can watch them whenever you want. Short video lectures that you can watch on your own schedule from any device at any time. One of the ones that some of you may be interested in is a video about cognitive behavioral therapy, where you can learn really valuable insights into how our thoughts, emotions, and our health are all intertwined, and how we can learn to use those connections to make beneficial changes to our own behaviors. I'd love for you to try The Great Courses Plus today. As one of my podcast listeners, you'll have a special opportunity to get a free month of unlimited access to all of The Great Courses Plus lectures when you sign up. Start your free month today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons. Okay, a few weeks have passed, and it's time to check in on Hope and see what she's been doing while we haven't been looking. Here we go.
Hello.
Hi, is that Hope?
It is.
It's Liz Gilbert. How you doing, Hope?
Good. How are you?
I am so good. I was kind of nervous when I picked up the phone to call you because I was looking back on the notes from our earlier conversation, and I realized that I gave you a shit ton of homework to do. I gave you so many assignments. I think I gave you more assignments than I gave anybody else this season. And I thought, man, I hope I didn't come down on her too hard with too much work. But do you want to just start and let me know if you were able to take any of that on, or what's it been like?
I did them all.
Yes. Hope for the win.
Yeah.
I love it. Do you want to just begin with wherever and let me know how it's been? I'm excited. Why don't you start with the homework assignment that you liked the best?
Okay. The one I liked the best was actually the letters.
Oh, cool.
The letter from my ancestor in particular, because I actually didn't know that much about my family. So I got to talk to my mom and kind of ask her for some advice, because I was just kind of stumped. I was like, I don't know how to write this letter. I need like a guidestone or like a point to start from. She's like, well, would it help if I told you my dad's mother's name? Because it gives you at least a name to write the letter
right
from. And I was like, yeah. So her name is Rose Warren. So having that name definitely grounded me, and I was able to write like a really, I was like crying as I was writing this really sweet letter from her to me. They just talked about her life and her experience and how it was kind of just her in letter form kind of whapping me on the back of the head and saying, like, what is wrong with you? how dare you squander this opportunity to use your voice?
Do you have that letter on hand by any chance, or could you summon it? Do you mind reading us a bit of it? I would love to hear what Rose Warren, and what a great name, what Rose Warren had to say from the past to Hope living in this moment about her present and her opportunities.
Sure. Dear Hope, my name is Rose Warren. I was your grandfather's grandmother. I was born to slaves on a plantation where I picked cotton. I am not able to read or write. My family is fractured, spread all over the country and the world. No one listens to the things I have to say, even though I have so many thoughts and ideas. Your grandfather tells me you have a degree. You are a writer. You get to stand in front of a crowd of people and a microphone, and folks stop to listen. You have a kind of magic in your blood, your bones. It's all these women before you that have screamed, begged, cried to be heard, pulling on the ears of those alive in your life that did not listen and who did not hear us to hear you now. Please make us proud. All the love, Rose Warren.
Oh, my God. Oh, Hope. Okay, not only am I crying, my producer through the window is crying on the other side.
Oh, no.
No, it's beautiful. And I have chills running up my body. Okay, you write like a dream.
Thank you.
And I'm,
that means so much to me.
What was that like to summon that voice?
It was so empowering. And it kind of made me kind of really think about what a privilege it is to be alive, in spite of everything that's going on, to be, you know, in the now where I have the opportunity to get on stage and have a microphone for 5 minutes at a time and say whatever I want into it with no consequences.
Yeah.
And it really made me appreciate that, what a privilege that is.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a responsibility in a way too, you know, and what a way of honoring not just all the women in your history who did not have the privilege of a public voice, but the millions of women still living today who don't,
mm-hmm.
you know, and who don't have the privilege of being criticized and insulted because they don't even get to have a voice. Wow, that's amazing. I'm so glad you did that. And I'm so glad you found her name and now you get to have her.
Okay.
Like when you get up on stage, she's with you forever. And did you write one to your great-grandchildren also? Or from your great-grandchildren?
I did. I will say it's a little less impactful.
Well, that's all right. They're, you know,
that
they're
one
just
was a little harder.
They're just kids.
Right. That's true.
They don't have the resonance and the gravitas of Rose Warren. But do you mind sharing that one too? I would love to hear that.
Oh, no problem. So, dear great grandma, I found your book online and started reading it. You have a lot of really interesting thoughts, kind of random, but really funny. It's nice to know you have a lot of the same feelings as me. Sadness, feeling lonely, feeling heartbroken. It's an interesting way to be. You encouraged me to start a little journal that I jot my notes down in. I'm glad we have a talented writer in the family so I can pick your brains about things or life. We're not wealthy or famous, but we're open. We talk about issues. We talk about the things that we love, the things that we hate. We share with one another and the world, at least the things we choose to, and we have you to thank. All my love, your great-grandchild.
Oh, my God. I love you so much, Hope. I love that you did this. It's so cool. So now you have the brackets on either end, mm-hmm. right? The people that you're speaking for because they didn't get to and the people who you're setting an example to so that they can have voices too. It's so great. It's so, so, so great. Okay. Next assignment. I do believe that I asked you to send a poem out to a journal or to go to a poetry slam. Were you able to do either of those things?
I did both of them.
What? All right. Start talking. What happened?
So I wanted my mother to kind of better understand how the slam world differs from like a regular open mic. So there was a conference in town and she came with me. She was like my guest to a couple of the workshops. And at the very end of the night, they were having a really casual slam. And I was like, hey, Mom, this is how the slam works. It'll be really cool. I want you to see it. And they only had two people sign up. And the guy who runs it runs the open mic that I go to. And he's like, hey, Hope, do you want to sign up for the slam? And I was like, no, it's okay. I just really want my mom to see it. And she was like, no, I think it would help me more if I saw you go up and do your thing.
Uh-huh.
So I signed up a little against my will, but also I feel like I needed permission from people to do a thing I kind of wanted to do anyway.
Uh-huh.
And I competed, and there were only three of us, and I got third place.
I love it. Yes.
But what kind of stuck out to me, other than my mom better understanding how a slam works, was one of the women who ran a workshop, who I had had very casual run-ins previously, came over to me, and she said, this one line you said just broke my heart. And as she said this, she collapsed onto the table very dramatically. And I was just so touched that she, you know, who's this very well-known local writer who runs her own open bike and led one of the workshops, had something really honest and kind to say about something that I wrote in a slam I didn't even think I was going to compete in.
That is so, do you remember what the line is that broke her heart? Because now, of course, as a language whore, I need to know.
It was, I remember the poem exactly.
Give us the whole poem.
Okay.
Here's your next, this is your next open mic. Hit it. Go. I just signed you up.
I'll have to pull it up. I don't have it, like, ready.
That's all right. I'm not going anywhere.
I found it.
Okay.
If I counted the times I almost kissed you, it would be 93. The first time was at the pool. You were laying on a raft, and I thought how beautiful you looked in the sun, like a baby deer speckled and innocent. The 27th time, you're in the passenger seat of my car. You leaned over to hug me goodbye. My lips brushed your collarbone. I think part of me is still brushing your collarbone, marking it as my territory. The 49th time it was snowing, I was telling you I loved you. You were telling me you were sorry. The reason you were sorry was a girl saved in your phone under sweetheart. The 58th time we were dancing, I could feel the sadness in your steps. Your feet were crashing into mine like a car hitting the meridian, like you didn't want to survive the wreckage. I wanted to suck the sadness out of your mouth. I remember thinking it would taste like whiskey. The 71st time, you were telling me you were leaving. You had already started packing things. I stopped breathing. You moved close like you were going to give me CPR, but you stopped, and I let you stop. Why did I let you stop? The 84th time, we were dressed up and drinking like there was no tomorrow. I kept burning napkins in the restaurant. You told me that I was bad news. I wanted to show you what bad news felt like. The 93rd time, I was in your backyard. Everyone was saying goodbye. I was the last one to leave. You held me until I ran out of tears and words simultaneously. was a perfect moment I didn't want to ruin with inexperience. I've kissed 94 boys since he's left. I think I've gotten pretty good at it. They all say my mouth tastes like ruin, tastes like hollow, tastes like waiting for you to come back and pick me. I can't wait for you to pick me. I can't wait for you to pick me. You wouldn't pick me up at a lineup, wouldn't pick me up off the floor. You wouldn't send your spit my way if I was on fire. Baby, I'm on fire. My next kiss won't be wasted on you or someone I'm closing my eyes and pretending it's you. My almost darling, 187 kisses and almost kisses later, you don't get to be a milestone. You get to be a memory.
Wow. Wow. That works. That works. That works in my mind and my heart and my body. Hope. You got the stuff. Wow. They gave you 3rd out of 3 for that?
Yeah.
What's the matter with these fools?
Here in Ohio.
Man, what are they doing over there in Ohio? Who are you competing against? The ghost of Seamus Haney? Jesus. Hey, that's beautiful and amazing. And I got to say, like, I love that you came in 3rd out of 3 because, like, that's sort of your biggest fear, right? So it just happened and you won anyway. Like, you did it and you walked out of there on 2 feet and you got to see that it's still awesome. You know, I have a friend who's a marathoner and she said, and she's not very good. I mean, whatever that even means. I shouldn't say that. I've never run more than 4 miles in my life. But she's, you know, she's not great at it, but she does it and she's really super slow. And she said when she looks at the statistics of the finishers, they always have a list. And like these are all the people who finished in the order in which they finished. And then there's a huge list that says did not finish, like DNF, did not finish. And she said then there's this infinite list that she always keeps in her mind, which is DNS, did not start.
Oh.
Right? So even those people on the did not finish list are ahead of the people who didn't even start, you know? And so like anything like the movement that you did of going to the slam, signing up, showing up, delivering your work, like you're on the list. Like you're on the list and most people aren't because most people are on the DNS list. So I love it. Oh my God, you're making my day. Okay, did you send something to a journal? That's in a way the scariest one I think for you because I remember you got emotional when you were talking about what it would be like to get a rejection letter. But I was wondering if you were able to, if Rose Warren was able to help you do that.
I did, and I got rejected. But
great.
I took your advice, and I have a manila folder that is my rejection folder.
Yes. Love it. And I hope someday it will be thick with rejection letters like mine is. Welcome to the team. Welcome to the team of people who are in the game with all their skin in the game. It's so, so good. And I have to ask you too, did you listen to the conversation that I had about you with Martha Beck?
I did.
What'd you think of that?
It was so great. I took so many notes.
I know. Every time she opens her mouth, I take notes. She sends me a text and I take notes. Everything that woman does, I take notes. What was it that stuck out for you the most in that conversation?
I loved every time you go into the fire, you come out with a new life and it's better than the last one. Like that was the one that really gave me chills.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true. And it's true. And I recently had to do it. And I remember just, and it was those words that got me through that moment. I was just standing on the brink of that bonfire saying, Martha says, you got to jump in the fire because either you're going to find out that it's warm and nourishing or you will be burned to cinders and you get to have a new life on the other side. And it is amazing to live your life that way. It's so cool. And it also reflects the line in your poem saying, I'm on fire, I'm on fire. You're on fire because you keep walking into the fire. You know, that's where people like you are supposed to live, in the bonfire, one of them after another. It's so good. It's so, so, so good. So any other things you want to report about what you're putting out into the world, what you're working on now, how you're feeling?
So taking that first little slam step, I took it another step further And there have been a couple of boar slams that I've done. And every time I've gotten last place. There have been four total.
This is so, you have no idea how important it is for people to hear this, Hope. You know, like, you know, it's so much. I mean, I know it's probably hard for you, but it's going to be so much better for everyone else, this version of the story. Like, look, this is what it looks like. You put yourself out there, you get slammed. You put yourself out there again, you get slammed. So you've done four. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Is it terrifying every time?
It is. It really is. Until the very last second when I hear my name called, I consider, you know, sprinting out of there and running to my car.
And then what happens when you hear your name called?
I remember something my mom used to tell me when I'd get really, really stressed about school, but it was an assignment or a project. She would just say, you know, whatever the deadline was, either way, there'll become a time when it was over and you will have not died.
Yes, you will have not died.
So the least you can do is attempt, do the best you can, because it's not going to kill you. No. And I have found that extremely helpful. Just repeating to myself, like, it will not kill me, it will not kill me. And what I've been adding lately is, it will not kill me, I will not let it.
I will not let it. Actually, it will do the opposite. It will bring you into life. It will bring you into life. It will so far from kill you that it's like directly the opposite of killing you. There's a story that I love. I know somebody who is a dancer. She was a dancer at the Martha Graham Dance Company, and she told me a story that an older woman dancer told her about a dance based on the life of Joan of Arc that was really complex and really powerful and really terrifying. And this dancer at the time didn't know, you know, it was one of those things where you're asked to do something better than you're capable of doing, you know? And so she was pushed to star in this dance that she really didn't know if she was ready to do. And she said she was standing in the wings and she was so afraid and she was so insecure and she was so certain she was going to fail. And she said, my prayer, I sent this prayer up that the earth would open and I could just disappear and vanish into the earth. And she said, and then it did. The earth opened and I vanished into it. And out onto the stage stepped Joan of Arc. It's like that person's gone. Like Hope Hill at that moment in the wings, sort of the earth opens and the old you is swallowed and this other thing goes out on the stage. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of being given that spotlight for a few minutes. And it's so cool that you're doing it. It's so cool. I can't wait till you come in second to last. Hope, you're amazing, and you have just a host of saints and ghosts and spirits helping you through this now. You've got your great-grandmother on call. You've got your great-grandchildren on call. You've got me and Martha Beck looking over you. You've got your mom coming to Poetry Slams with you, and there's nothing you cannot do.
So good to hear.
It's true. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about your life. It's going to be so inspiring to so many people. You have no idea.
It's my pleasure.
You're an influencer, Hope. You're an influencer. Oh. Watch and see the influence that you're going to have. It's wonderful. And I don't need to tell you, but keep stepping into that fire.
All right. I will.
Lots of love, sweetie.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope you'll join us next time. Magic Lessons is a production of the Maximum Fun Network. Michelle Siegel is our extraordinary producer. Our theme music is by Dave Cahill, and it was performed by Dave Cahill and Dallas Vietti. Special thanks to Paul Ruest of Argo Studios and Jesse Thorne of Maximum Fun. You can hear all the episodes and find out a lot more about my comings and goings at elizabethgilbert.com. And of course, if you want to continue your own explorations into creativity or hear more of what I have to say about this subject, you can pick up my book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, which is published by Riverhead Books and which is coming out in paperback next week. I hope you'll pick up a copy. If you can, please leave us a comment on iTunes. It helps other people discover the show, and we appreciate it. And let's keep this conversation going on Facebook and Twitter. I'm @GilbertLiz. See you next time.
Hey there, European Max Funsters. Do not miss your chance to catch some of your favorite Max Fun shows live at the London Podcast Festival, September 22nd through 26th. See amazing guests like Armando Iannucci, Josie Long, and Romare on stage with Jesse Thorne during Bullseye, bust a gut at classic panel show hijinks with International Waters, and witness some tough but fair internet justice dispensed by Judge John Hodgman himself. The Beef and Dairy Network show is already sold out, but hey, at least you can enjoy being in the proximity of the premier expert on beef animals and dairy herds, right? More guests will be announced soon and tickets are going fast. Go to MaximumFun.org for tickets right now so you don't live a life steeped in regret.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.